I was out very late last night, so I'm still waking up. So let's begin just by recalling where we got to last time. And this time we'll have a big drum roll because we're going to see the Einstein equations for the first time. So recall all these horrible indices. The Riemann the connection when we assumed no torsion and zero metricity, the connection was given by this formula, first derivative of the metric. The Riemann tensor is given by is constructed from this connection and involves second derivatives of the metric. And if you remember, in four dimensions, d equals 4, there are 20 independent components. Of the metric. So you can, roughly speaking, think of the curvature of a general curved manifold being described by 20 functions of the coordinates. Okay, so let's just begin by asking, are there any questions about this? Because we're going to use this to proceed. So basically, if you work in general relativity, these formulae should be etched in your brain, and they're really the basis for everything else. So I can't overemphasize the importance of understanding and appreciating these formulae. Luckily, these days we can calculate these things on a computer. There are standard programs. You can just plug in the metric and it'll spit out the Riemann tensor. So all the labor of it has been removed. But so it's easy for you to conceptualize and play with manifolds and their curvatures. Certain things, when you stare at this formula, I haven't emphasized them before, but you can sort of see, you see from the first term, gamma mu nu lambda, it just the indices line up. And then the second term is obeyed on the top by just exchanging lambda and rho, because Riemann is antisymmetric under the last two indices. And likewise, the third term, you can see that the indices line up. The mu is top right, and then nu lambda rho. Other two have to be contracted. And then you just exchange lambda and rho to get the last term, and you know Riemann must be antisymmetric under those last two indices. So it's actually not too hard to even remember these formulae, as long as you remember the symmetries of Riemann and so on. No. If you, do you mean if you have torsion?
Yeah.
No. There's a correction term if you include torsion, which I didn't give you. But if the metric has torsion, the let me just say it. Sorry. Let me just say this properly. No. I'm sorry. I'm wrong. That is the perhaps I've been a little confusing because I assumed torsion was zero. This is the correct formula where those gammas should be interpreted as the Christoffel symbol. Okay, so the Riemann tensor by definition is only a function of the metric, not the torsion. The formulae I told you which need correcting are the following. So with torsion, so the above formula for gamma is in the absence of torsion. Okay, so that the connection with torsion gamma equals Christoffel plus plus the torsion T mu nu lambda. Right, so the Christoffel symbol is the symmetric part of the connection, and the torsion is the anti-symmetric part. But in this formula for the recent Riemann tensor, these gammas should really be the Christoffel symbol. Riemann tensor, by definition, is constructed from the metric. Okay? And in Riemann set gamma equals Christoffel. Okay, so that gets corrected. Okay, so the formula for the commutator, for example, d mu d nu minus d nu d mu. So one formula we had is that this was equal to minus r gamma. R gamma alpha mu nu v gamma. That was one of our formulae. The commutator of derivatives on a downstairs index gave minus the Riemann tensor. But this is actually corrected. If you have torsion, there's an extra piece. The torsion beta mu nu, also antisymmetric under mu and nu, like the commutator, times d beta v alpha. And similarly, the same thing on v alpha would be plus the Riemann tensor alpha up here. This gamma index contracted with the gamma, and then plus okay, so that's the correction to those formulae. And this torsion, you need some other equation to determine the torsion. General relativity doesn't do that for you. Right, so I will need one more identity for the Riemann tensor, which is very important. The Bianchi identity. And the Bianchi identity is constructed from the Riemann tensor, is an identity for derivatives of the Riemann tensor. Let me introduce this notation. Remember, comma rho means d by dx rho. Semicolon rho means covariant derivative with respect to rho. Okay, so we often write covariant derivatives using semicolons. And then the Bianchi identity looks like this. You just cycle the last three indices. So it just involves cycling these three indices. Alpha, beta, k, mu, co, nu, plus r, alpha, beta, nu, k, mu. And this equals zero. And that's equivalent to, because Riemann is anti-symmetric on the indices mu and nu, then just as before, when you construct the tensor by cycling three indices, two of which are anti-symmetric, that's the same as just anti-symmetrizing. So that's equivalent to r alpha beta anti-symmetrizing mu nu colon kappa. Okay, so can anyone tell me where this comes from? Let me just remind you, the Riemann tensor itself satisfied some identity like this. Beta mu nu was zero, right, when we anti-symmetrize on the last three indices or alternatively just cycle them. The Riemann tensor was zero. What did that correspond to? Where did we get that from? Why is it true? Pardon? Do you remember which identity it came from? Jacobi identity. Yeah, that came from, this came from d mu, sorry. Yeah, d mu, d nu, d lambda plus cycles equals zero. Jacobi. The Jacobi identity told us then when you construct this commutator of commutator with of a commutator and you cycle it, then it's automatically zero. And this ends up implying that the Riemann tensor has this symmetry. But this was obtained from this acting on a scalar. And so this equation turns out to follow from a similar Jacobi identity. And what do you think it might be? You see, in this case, acting on a vector. Because in this case, I acted with this guy on the scale, I got a vector. And now I have the commutator of derivatives on a vector that gives the Riemann tensor. Okay? If I instead calculate this d mu, d nu, d lambda plus cycles on a vector equals zero, well, I just get the Riemann immediately from the commutator. Okay? And then I take the derivative of the Riemann. And that gives you this equation. So this this is the Jacobi identity. It's very, very important differential equation constraining the Riemann tensor. And it has an immediate consequence, which I'm just going to steal some chalk. So consequence of Bianchi let us contract it with a metric on the first and third index. If I contract on the first and second, I'm going to get zero because the Riemann tensor is anti-symmetric under flipping those two or those two. So essentially, all I can do is contract with the first and the third. So we'll do this. G alpha mu G beta kappa. Okay, so I'm contracting the first with the third and the second with the derivative index, so the thing I've got left, well, let's write it down, R alpha beta mu mu kappa cycles on these indices. And what you see, well, actually, let me just write it down, because then we'll work out all the terms. R alpha beta kappa mu nu plus R alpha beta nu kappa mu. So this one is going to give me the Ricci tensor. When I contract the first and third, I get the Ricci tensor. And this guy just raises the index to beta. So I get R beta nu d beta. this one, I get this is contracting alpha with mu. So remember, this is antisymmetric under mu and kappa. So if I flip the mu with the kappa, now I get the Ricci scalar. So I get minus R beta k nu, but I've got to contract with this beta k, and the contraction of the Ricci tensor just gives me the Ricci scalar. So I just get R nu, semicolon nu, which is just minus d nu R. And this one, alpha with mu, let's see, beta with kappa gives me the Ricci tensor, R alpha mu, alpha nu. And then this guy raises the mu index to an alpha. So what I get is d alpha R alpha nu. Okay, so what I've got is an identity that the sum of these things is zero. And we can reorganize that, or d beta r beta nu. There are two terms here. So let's, these two terms are identical. So let's divide by 2. And then what I've got here is just g beta mu r equals 0 with a factor of a half. Beta nu, sorry. Since, remember, the covariant derivative doesn't do anything to the metric. And so we define another tensor, g beta nu, to be Ricci tensor minus 1/2 r. And that satisfies d beta g beta nu equals 0. And this is called the Einstein tensor. Okay, so Einstein realized that actually, after making a mistake with his equation, he realized that this combination of Ricci tensor and Ricci scalar is covariantly constant, or is conserved. Okay, so that is how, that's a very important identity. And the reason why it's so important is that matter in relativity the density, we want something to relate the density of matter to the curvature of spacetime. Now, the density of matter or energy, because of E equals mc squared, the density is described by the stress energy tensor. And so the stress energy tensor is the following. It's a two-component tensor. Well, let's just write it down. Let me write it down before I give you the final formula, T mu nu. So this was already known at the time of Einstein, that the density per unit volume of energy is described by a tensor. It's not a scalar quantity. And so imagine we've got some stuff which has energy density. And imagine it has a velocity. So the stuff, for you can think of the stuff as a collection of particles or radiation or whatever. It has some four velocity. And the four velocity is a function of x. So the four velocity tells you how the stuff is moving. If you sit with the material or fluid and you watch it going past you, it goes past with some velocity. This four velocity obeys g mu nu u mu u nu equals minus 1, just like the four velocity of a massive particle. So you can always pick a rest frame. In the rest frame of a fluid, okay, so a fluid is something with density, velocity, and pressure, the stress energy tensor, the four velocity, u mu, is just 1, 0. Okay, remember the four velocity of a particle was dx mu d tau for a particle. U mu was equal dx mu d tau, which was equal to dt d tau dx d tau, right? And d tau was equal to square root of... there's a c here to get the dimensions right. C d tau is c squared dt squared minus dx squared. D tau was the proper time measured by along the particle path. And so you can see from this that eta mu nu u mu u nu equals d tau squared. Now I just want to check that I get the dimensions right. D tau is c squared d tau squared over c squared d tau squared, which is with a minus sign. Where does the minus sign come from?
D tau is minus
the... No, that doesn't. No, this is the proper time. Okay. You just think carefully. You'll see it. Yes, of course. So eta mu nu with u mu u nu is going to give a minus here, right? So I'm going to get minus. I can just write it out. Write it out. This is going to give minus dt squared over c squared d tau squared. Plus dx squared over c squared d tau squared, but this is minus 1. Okay, so in the rest frame of the particle, of course, it's not moving. Dx dt is 0, and u0 is 1 because t is the I needed a c there as well, right? Yeah, there's a c there as well. So you, in the rest frame of the particle, u0 is 1, and the spatial components are 0. And likewise, for a fluid, we say that if you're moving with the fluid, the four velocity of the fluid is just 1, 0. The fluid is basically just moving in the time direction, but not in space. And the stress tensor in the rest frame of the fluid is defined to be the density of the fluid, rho of x C squared, where rho is the mass per unit volume, mass density per unit volume. Okay, and then we're using, okay, let me just check that I've got this right. Yeah. Then we're using E equals mc squared, and this T naught naught is really the energy density per unit volume of the fluid. So by definition, T naught naught is the energy density. In this rest frame, the fluid has no fore velocity. T naught I is zero in that frame. T naught I represents the flow of the fluid, as we'll see. But in the rest frame of the fluid, in the rest frame of fluid, you see a fluid by definition is isotropic. So one imagines sitting at a point, the fluid, if you're sitting there in the middle of a fluid, all directions are the same, so you shouldn't have any preferred direction. But the Tij, the spatial parts of the stress tensor, are given by the pressure. Pressure of x, delta ij. Okay, so a fluid is isotropic actually only really true for a perfect fluid. Fluid is isotropic in its rest frame. Yep.
So we're assuming that the density of matter is basically fluid, right? Or matter is fluid in the universe.
Yes.
Why can you assume
that? Let's assume it for simplicity. Okay. Let's just assume it for simplicity. Yeah.
So when you say you go to the rest frame of the fluid, are you only doing that locally? Are different pieces of the liquid allowed to move with respect to each other?
Yes, they are. So you know the Navier-Stokes equation describes how a fluid moves and the velocity changes and so on. The assumption of the Navier-Stokes equation is that the fluid is completely described by pressure. And right there, you're assuming isotropy. Because right there, pressure means, what does pressure mean? It means that at every point, there's some scalar quantity telling me, which tells me, when I take its gradient, it tells me the force exerted on a fluid element. So this is just the assumption made in the Navier-Stokes equation. You do have anisotropic fluids, and they have more complicated stress energies and so on. But let's just discuss isotropic. I mean, this is what Einstein knew. Yeah.
And other thing, you're defining the components of your stress energy tensor here, right? But shouldn't the
defining them in the rest frame?
Right. But shouldn't the stress energy tensor come directly from the action?
Yes.
Of the
it
system?
Should. Absolutely. It should. So in fact, we're going to derive that on Monday. How do you get the stress energy from the action?
Okay.
So this is a kind of phenomenological thing, right? So Einstein is figuring, how do I couple matter to curvature? Well, I know matter is always described by a stress energy tensor. And in the simplest case, it's an isotropic fluid. So let's start there. And so I really just want to motivate the formula I'm going to write down that, so for an isotropic fluid, the stress energy tensor is equal to P plus rho U mu U nu plus P G mu nu. Okay, so I didn't want to just write that down without some motivation. I wanted to derive it by saying that if we're sitting in the rest, in fact, I should put a C squared in here. I'm trying to get all my C's right. If you remember from freshman physics, the pressure of a gas of particles, right, is 1/3 nmv squared, right? you remember that formula? You just put some particles in a box, and they're moving around with some speed v. The pressure is 1/3 number density mass v squared. This is the number per unit volume. And so you see that pressure has units of mass density times velocity squared. Okay, and therefore I need a c squared here to make this have the same units as that. And you see the units of stress energy tensor are energy density per unit volume. So having defined, you see, in fact, this is the definition of the stress tensor for an isotropic fluid. You say there exists a frame in which T naught naught is the, by definition, the energy density per unit volume. In the rest frame, T naught I is zero, because it's isotropic, there can't be a special direction. And the Tij, by definition, is the pressure, and by definition is isotropic, because it's an isotropic fluid. If you know that, and you know that the four velocity is this vector, then actually you can infer this must be the stress tensor in any frame. Okay, why is that true? Because this formula is correct in this frame, okay? But it's a tensor equation. Any tensor equation is independent of frame. Okay, so let's just check it in this frame. Just check that it's correct. So in the rest frame, okay, T naught naught equals, well, these U naughts are 1, G naught naught is minus 1. We'll do it in, I put a G here. I should, let's stay in Minkowski space. Okay, we're going to go to curved space just by replacing that with a G, but let me not do that now. So in the rest frame, T naught naught is P plus rho C squared, because the U naughts are 1, and then from here I get minus 1 minus P, so rho C squared. T naught I is equal to 0, because UI is 0, and eta naught I is 0, and Tij, the UI and UJ are 0, but this is equal to P, delta IJ. Okay, so we've proven that this tensor equation is true in the rest frame. Okay, and by definition, P and rho are scalars, scalar quantities. That means they're not changed by Lorentz transformation. Okay, and so this is true, this is true in the rest frame. And therefore, it's true in any frame. Provided P and rho are scalars. So P and rho do not transform under Lorentz transformations. Okay, so the meaning of P and rho, it really means the pressure in the rest frame and the density in the rest frame. Yeah?
Okay, so this tensor is manifestly symmetric, right?
Yes.
Is there a physical reason why it should be symmetric?
Yes.
And is it?
We'll do that on Monday. Yeah?
So your discussion is still under the frame of special relativity?
Yes. At the moment. So I'm trying to be Einstein. Okay, I wish. I'm trying to be Einstein. I want to couple the curvature of space-time, which I know is described by Riemann. I'm trying to couple it to matter. So now, obviously, the curvature is a local thing. It's a function of x. I need some function of x which describes the matter. It must be the density of the matter. It's not a number. It has to be a function of x. At each spatial point, there's some matter density. How is that described? And Einstein knew that density of matter is the density of matter is a part, or naturally a part, of a two-component symmetric tensor called a stress-energy tensor. You see, the concept of stress energy tensor is more general than a fluid. fluid has a rho, it has a p, it has a u, but if we talk about Maxwell's equations, you could say, what's the energy density of the electromagnetic field? Okay, that's also a stress tensor with two indices, symmetric two-index tensor. And the basic property of T mu nu, the basic property, the reason why we talk about it at all, of T mu nu is that it is conserved. Okay? And what we mean by conserved is that the derivative, the divergence of T mu nu, d mu T mu nu equals 0. Okay? That equation incorporates, it's four equations. Nu can take run over four values. The zero component describes energy conservation, and the three spatial components describe momentum conservation. Let me go over there. Okay, so in fact, for a non-relativistic fluid, well, let's see, for an isotropic fluid, d mu t mu nu equals 0 gives you the Navier-Stokes equations. Yeah.
Is that the standard derivative?
Yes. So I mean, it's still in flat space.
It's still in flat space.
Still in flat space.
So in flat space, will it go to
yeah.
The
so, derivative? Yeah. So I should have put in special relativity up there, okay? In special. So this much was known. Okay? So Einstein said, in general relativity, T mu nu is exactly what it was in special, where you replace eta by g mu nu. Okay, that's obviously the thing to do to satisfy the equivalence principle. And then you expect, and conservation of stress energy becomes covariant derivative. Okay, so if you can build that into your theory, then you know it will satisfy the equivalence principle. Let me just spell out why this implies conservation of energy, these four equations. So here I get d naught of t naught naught plus di of t I naught equals 0. Okay, that's just writing out the 0 component of this equation, if nu equals 0. Okay? Now, what does that mean? It means that, you see, if I take this equation and integrate it over space, the first component, this integral commutes with the time derivative, the first component gives me the total energy. T naught naught was, by definition, the energy density. And so this gives me, so integral d3. So let's put the d naught out here. This means d by dt of the energy. And this part here says integral of the divergence of Ti naught d3x. And here I can use the divergence theorem. Theorem, right? The integral of a total divergence is just the integral of the vector dotted in with the surface. So this becomes integral Ti naught dsi. So I've got some volume V in space with a surface S. And this integral becomes a surface integral. And all this is telling you is that the rate of change of energy in some volume is equal to minus the integral of the flux of momentum across the surface of the volume. Okay, so if nothing's happening on the surface of the volume, like if the surface is at infinity and no energy is escaping at infinity, then the energy will be conserved. And the I component of the equation does the same for momentum. That integral d3x ti naught is the total momentum of the system. And by the same argument, the total momentum is conserved if nothing is happening on, if nothing is entering or leaving the system on the surface of the volume. So that's why this equation describes the conservation of energy and momentum. And of course, we know where this equation came from. This equation from Noether's theorem comes from the symmetry of Minkowski space under translations and in time or in space. Okay, so this was, Einstein knew this. I'm actually going to keep that formula, so I'll get rid of that one. I want that middle one. Yes.
Even though there is, I can have one direction that it's privileged.
Conservation of the energy momentum comes from the symmetries of Minkowski spacetime. It really doesn't matter what you put in it. Providing you're putting it in Minkowski space, it has to be conserved. Yeah.
Question that's kind of unrelated to this, but going back to what we were saying earlier about so if I write down a tensor equation in some set of coordinates that has to be true in any coordinate?
Yes.
I'm wondering, so like...
So you see, the argument is, okay, when I write an equation down like this,
yes,
so it was true in one frame. Now I say, what is the meaning of these quantities in another frame? Well, in special relativity, the meaning is if I go to another frame, I just multiply by lambdas, right? So this becomes lambda alpha mu, lambda beta nu. This gives me the T in the other frame. But it is the same with the u's. And the eta, of course, is invariant. So the same equation just defines what everything is in the other frame. So if it's true in one frame, it must be true in every frame.
It sounds funny, like if I look at the Riemann tensor and if I chose coordinates so that my connection coefficients vanish.
Yes.
And I just wrote down the Riemann tensor in those coordinates, then that wouldn't be valid in another coordinate frame. But by doing a coordinate transformation, I would get back those terms. Is that what we're saying?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly right. Put the connection back in. Yes, you see, so exactly right. So if I computed in a coordinate system where the gammas vanished at a point, then the Riemann would be exactly this. Okay, now I say, well, what is it in some other coordinate system? The problem is this is not a tensor. So I can't just lift this formula into the other system. It's just not true in the other system. And when I do the coordinate transformation of this, because it's not a tensor, it's going to generate these terms. Okay? And if you wrote a tensor equation, then it's valid in all systems. But the first part is not a tensor equation. The whole thing is the tensor equation. And the whole thing is valid in any coordinate system. It just happens that the gammas are zero in one coordinate system.
So if I had naively written down the Riemann tensor in a nice coordinate system, then yeah. I would have seen that it's not a tensor, so I have to do some kind of
exact
coordinate transformation to see.
Exactly.
OK,
yeah, yeah.
I see.
OK, so where are we? We've got the stress energy tensor, which describes matter. And as I say, the reason why Einstein would not be satisfied, in fact, this is not even true. The first attempts to write down an equation for relativity really just involved the scalar quantity. Okay, so you might say, let me just try to define the energy density of matter and couple this to gravity. So I can write down, for example, the Ricci scalar equals the energy density. That might be your simplest equation you could write down. And people played with this equation, these kinds of equations, and nothing worked. And so then Einstein realized that the energy density more generally is a part of a stress energy tensor. That's how it is in Maxwell's theory. And so let's try to couple gravity to the stress energy tensor. And that worked. Okay, so let's try to see how to do that. To do that, we know Newton's law of gravity, and we can try to go directly from Newton's law to Einstein's law. So I'm going to call this from Newton to Einstein. So we're going to infer the Einstein equation by just thinking about completely ordinary particles moving slowly in a gravitational field. So a slowly moving particle, velocity is much less dx c d tau much less than 1. Okay, so for a slowly moving particle, then of course d tau is approximately c dt because the dx term is so much smaller. Let's put a t there. If dx is much smaller than c dt, then d tau is approximately dt. And the geodesic equation is d2xi dt squared plus gamma I 0, 0 equals 0 becomes. Okay, so if we think about the geodesic equation and just take the I component, there was a d2x by d tau squared, but tau is approximately t, the time. And then here we had d, you see, dx mu the tau is approximately, well, in the time component, this is just C. Okay, sorry about the C's. I'm always putting them back. Dxi dt. That's right. So I guess I need a I need a C squared here. Let's check. Yeah. So in the geodesic equation, the dx mu dt is approximately C. This one is much bigger than that. So let's just forget about this term. Let's just forget about the velocity term. Then the geodesic equation becomes this. And let's work out gamma I 0, 0. Well, that is 1/2 gij. Let me tell you what g is. So slowly moving particle in a nearly flat metric. Okay, g mu nu is approximately Minkowski space plus some small correction. So gamma I 0, 0, gamma I 0, 0, is equal to g I mu, g 0 mu comma 0 plus g 0 mu comma 0 minus g 0 0 comma mu. A nearly flat metric and a nearly flat and nearly static metric. Okay, let me write that down. Nearly flat, nearly static metric. So the whole idea is to consider a particle moving in a metric that is hardly changing with time. Okay, so g mu nu is eta mu nu plus h mu nu, and we're going to neglect time derivatives, d naught h mu nu. And h mu nu is going to be small. H mu nu is going to be much less than 1. So here's my the connection, which comes into the equation. Now, this involves derivatives. Anything with a time derivative I'm going to ignore because I'm in a slowly changing metric. This g00 is eta00, which is just minus 1, so that doesn't have any derivative. But there's an h00. So here I get minus h00. And then I'm going to ignore time derivatives. So the mu index here must definitely be a spatial one to give a non-zero index. Okay, and then this has to be a j, so I get 1/2 gij times this. But I already have h here, so in the inverse metric is approximately eta mu nu minus h mu nu. Okay, so if the original metric is close to flat space with a small correction, then the inverse metric is the inverse of the Minkowski metric with a minus h mu nu. Okay, so you know that the inverse of 1 plus x is 1 minus x. Okay, well, it's the same with matrices, that if x is a matrix, and a small matrix, and I take the inverse of this, I get a minus sign. And they're higher order terms, which we're ignoring, plus order h squared. Okay, so the inverse metric is there. Now, this inverse metric I have here, but this is already of order h, which is a small quantity. kind of, so I can neglect the H term in the inverse there. And so this gamma I 0, 0, I just use a delta for this G. So it's 1 half minus 1 half from here, H 0, 0, comma I. And so what we get out of this is that d2x dt squared is equal to 1 half gradient of h00 times c squared. Well, slowly varying metric. Nearly Minkowski, the particle will be accelerated due to gradients in H, H00. Okay, so here comes the comparison with Newton. Comparison CF Newton. So Newton said that F equals ma, so mt2x dt squared was equal to the force, which is the mass times, for gravity, the minus the gradient of the gravitational potential. This is the gravitational potential. Potential. And the gravitational potential is given from Poisson's equation, del squared phi equals minus, equals plus 4 pi g rho, where this is the mass density. Okay, so this is exactly the same as the electrostatic potential in electrostatic theory, in Maxwell's theory, where you use the charge density here to source the potential, and then the potential, the gradient of the potential determines the force. Okay, so by comparing the geodesic equation here with Newton's formula, okay, you see in Newton's formula, of course, the mass cancels. So d2x dt squared is minus gradient phi. And this is CF, so this is Newton. In Einstein's theory, d2x dt squared equals 1 half gradient h naught naught c squared. And so then we can identify h naught naught as equal to minus 2 phi over c squared. Okay, so from this Newton could see that Einstein could see that his theory will automatically reproduce Newton's. If, I always do that. one day the mug is going to smash. Einstein could see that his theory would reproduce Newton's, at least for slowly moving particles in weak gravitational fields. And a weak gravitational field means that H naught naught is much less than 1. Okay? So just to give you some examples, you see phi over c squared, phi is the gravitational potential, and you know that phi goes like gm over r. in Newtonian theory, which goes like the circular velocity squared of a particle in orbit at that radius. And so phi over c squared is a dimensionless number, which is just the circular velocity squared divided by the speed of light squared. And so for the Earth, the velocity of a satellite orbiting the Earth, basically you just put in the radius of the Earth into that equation, and you see phi over c squared is approximately 10 to the minus 9. For the Sun, phi over c squared is approximately 10 to the minus 6. So particles orbiting the Sun just above the surface would be going at about 1/1000th the speed of light, because it's really just v over c all squared. And for a neutron star, it's a bit more exciting. Phi over c squared is about 10 to the minus 1. So a particle orbiting a neutron star just above its surface will be moving at 1/3 the speed of light. And that's why relativistic effects are very important in neutron star physics. Okay, but it means that for all these situations, except perhaps the neutron star, this number is much smaller than 1, and so the original assumption that the metric is close to being flat space is a pretty good assumption. Okay, so that's good, because now Einstein has connected the metric to something known in Newtonian physics. And in fact, let's just look at this equation. This implies that somehow del squared of h naught naught should equal to minus 2 del squared of phi minus 8 pi g over c squared del squared of phi, which is gives rho. Did I get that right? Yes. Okay, so already this is beginning to look a little bit like an equation for the Riemann curvature in terms of t, in terms of the energy density in the space-time. Okay, and this is, we're almost there at Einstein's equations. So let's try my hand again. So, recall, the Einstein tensor G alpha beta, which is R alpha beta minus 1/2 G alpha beta R, satisfies d mu G mu beta equals 0. That was a consequence of the Bianchi identities, right? The stress energy tensor T alpha beta satisfies D mu T mu beta equals 0. That's the generalized version of stress energy conservation in flat space time. And so this led Einstein to guess that G alpha beta is equal to some constant times T alpha beta. Okay, so at least this equation is consistent with the conservation of energy. If I take the divergence of the right-hand side, then it's zero, so the divergence of the left-hand side is zero by an identity. And so at least that's consistent. Now, there's a very famous photo of Einstein with this equation, where, in fact, he wrote this. Okay. Which is not consistent. And I think it was about 6 months before this was realized. It was a big race going on. I think it was around 1915. There's a big race to get the right equation, and Hilbert was involved, one of the most famous mathematicians in the world, and a frantic exchange of letters and correspondence, and finally he wrote this down, okay, which was the right equation. So we'll see that we can fix this constant just from what we already know by looking at this. That if we work out the left-hand side for a weak disturbance of Minkowski space, a weak gravitational field, h naught naught much less than 1, we'll find that the left-hand side is just grad squared h naught naught, and the right-hand side is part of t naught naught, and from this relation, we'll fix the coefficient exactly, and it'll turn out, so we'll do that now. So all we do is calculate g alpha beta for the metric equals Minkowski plus h alpha beta. And as before, h is small, ignore time derivatives, use the fact that the inverse metric is eta alpha beta minus h alpha beta plus order h squared. And we're just going to work to first order, to order h. And in fact, what we can do is use the formula on the top of the blackboard straight away. The Riemann tensor mu nu rho lambda equals 1/2. The gammas are all of order h. Right, because the gamma involves derivatives of the metric. Derivative of eta is 0. So gamma goes like derivative of h. So that formula where you have gamma squared, it's automatically h squared. So forget about that term. Everything interesting comes from the first term. And I can ignore derivatives of eta. So I just have h here. Mu nu rho lambda. Mu rho nu lambda minus h nu rho mu lambda minus h mu lambda nu rho plus h lambda nu rho mu plus order h squared. Okay. Now, in fact, it's good to reorganize this equation a little bit. So this is R alpha beta minus 1/2 g alpha beta r is equal to kappa t alpha beta. Notice if I take the trace of this equation, which means just contracting it with a g, then I get, so just multiply it with a g alpha beta, then I get R minus, and then here, G alpha beta is just 4, right? G alpha beta means raise one of these indices and sum over it, so it's delta alpha alpha, which is 4. Sorry? Yeah? G alpha beta is 4. So if I contract this equation with a G alpha beta, I get minus 2 R equals kappa T. All right, where T, by definition, is G alpha beta T alpha beta. And so from this, I see that R is equal to minus kappa T. And so I can pull this equation over to the I can pull this equation over to the right-hand side and rewrite this as R alpha beta equals kappa T alpha beta plus, that looks wrong. Where did I go wrong? Oh, yes. Yeah. So R alpha beta is T plus a half R G alpha beta, but R is minus T, so this is actually minus one half G alpha beta T. Okay? So this assumed equation implies this equation. And this equation is a little bit easier to calculate because the T is all on the right-hand side and all we need is R. And so what we need to do is calculate from this Riemann tensor R 0, 0. Okay, and R 0, 0 will be given by, let me do it with downstairs indices, it doesn't really matter. Because we're going, it's going to be of order h, and raising and lower indices will be with eta, and this h correction won't make any difference because the thing we're dealing with is h already. We want to ignore all h squared terms. So r 0, 0, what I've got to do is contract this with a eta mu rho, right, r mu 0 rho lambda. Sorry, 0. Okay, that's the R 0, 0. The reason I could use eta here instead of g is because the inverse metric, which I need to construct the Ricci tensor, involves eta plus h. But this is of order h already. There's no point in having an h squared term, so just forget about it. Okay, so this is R 0, 0. And now we notice we should neglect all time derivatives. The assumption was the time derivatives are small. So let's put 0, 0 for nu and lambda. Okay, so this goes, if nu and lambda equals 0, this goes, this goes, this goes. This one is the only non-zero piece. Okay, so we get this is eta mu rho. Eta mu rho 1 half h 0, 0, because lambda and u were 0, comma mu rho. But again, I ignore all time derivatives, right? So these mu and rho should only be space derivatives. So this is, and this is delta in the space directions. So this is 1 half grad squared h naught naught. That's all it is. Okay, so we're almost there. So R00, which is approximately 1/2 grad squared H00 equals kappa T00 minus 1/2 G00, which is which I'm going to approximate by eta 00 times T. Eta 00 is just minus 1. So yeah.
If we're going to order H, why is it okay to replace G by eta?
Because T will be of order H by the equation. So so basically, if the left-hand side is small, the right-hand side must be small. Okay. So the idea is that the curvature of space-time does sort of cause more curvature of space-time. But to first order, it's just the matter that's causing the curvature of space-time. And so so the idea, yeah, let me just say it that way. So we're going to replace G is eta plus H, and ignore the H. Okay? You can come back and check how big H is. You see, if you find, if you solve this equation and you find H is small, H is just a number, it's a dimensionless number. If H is small, then it's certainly less than eta. So you should have ignored it here. Okay? This is justified if H is small. Okay, we're almost there. Let me, except I've lost my place. Okay, now we're going to make some other assumptions about in T. We're going to assume the velocity of the fluid that u mu is approximately 1, 0. So the fluid is at rest. Fluid is almost at rest. It's just sitting there. And we're going to assume that the pressure is much less than rho c squared. Okay, that's totally plausible. The pressure, as I said, in an ordinary gas of particles is 1/3 nmv squared. So as long as the velocities of the particles is much smaller than the speed of light, this is a very good assumption. So e.g., ideal gas, pressure is rho v squared, where v is the velocity of the particles. So just ignore the pressure, ignore the velocity of the fluid. The only component of T is T00. So T mu nu is just equal to a 4x4 matrix with zeros everywhere else. Okay, so the trace T is equal to eta mu nu T mu nu. I just have to put a minus 1 in here, so that's minus rho c squared. And T with two downstairs indices, I lower both of these indices. Two minus signs just gives me a plus rho c squared. And so over here, I get kappa rho c squared. This is plus 1/2 times T, which is minus rho c squared. And so this is kappa over 2 rho c squared. Okay, and now let's compare it with this equation compared with star, which was that del squared H naught naught was equal to minus, have I got a minus sign? Sorry, del. I think that R naught naught should have had a minus sign in it. Where did that come from? Anybody see the minus sign?
It doesn't come from the eta eta zero.
Sorry?
The last line of the first one.
In the last line.
The first one, you have R zero zero equals eta mu rho, H rho, A zero zero mu rho, right?
Let's bring that one down. Here? So let's see, R00, I would, I think this is correct, right? And so I need nu equals zero, lambda equals zero, and rho mu. Okay. The correct result should be with the minus sign. Let me just see if I can get it. IJ. Pardon?
If the energy
don't want it. Say that. I'm pretty sure there should be a minus sign here. It may be.
Is the problem in the star equation on the left?
Sorry?
Is the problem in the star equation on the left where grad squared h zero zero equals, should that be a plus instead of a minus?
No. No, this is,
In the one below that.
Okay, let's see. We know that the metric goes like 1 plus 2, 5. I think this one's good, right? And this is good. So, yeah, I think this is correct. Poisson is always with a plus sign, yeah. That's related to the negative. Poisson is plus. Yeah, I think this is all right. What I suspect is. I'm suspicious of my formula for the Riemann, which I've erased. Say again? No, because you lower two indices. When you lower two indices, you get a plus sign. Okay, I will find the minus sign. I am suspecting that actually where it is that the formula I gave you for this Riemann equals 1/2 with the G's. I'm suspecting that should actually be a minus there. I believe that should be a minus. Okay. My apologies. I'll check this over the weekend. Okay, here we have a minus. Minus. Okay. And where are we? I'm now lost. Let's go back to the top board. Okay, I think. Okay, and let's compare it to the other equation, 8 pi g rho over c squared. Okay, and so what we read off from this is that just substituting in here for d squared h naught naught, I get plus 4 pi g rho over c squared equals kappa over 2 rho c squared. And so kappa equals 8 pi g over c to the fourth. Okay, and now we have the drum roll. Okay, modulo the minus sign. g alpha beta equals 8 pi g over c to the fourth t alpha beta. And that is Einstein's equation. Okay. Any questions? Pardon?
Basically, the guess was that since both the Einstein tensor and the energy momentum tensor vanishing covariant derivative, you're assuming that, I mean, you're guessing that
they're
two
equal.
Of them are proportional, but
exactly.
That might not be the case, right? I mean, so it's a lucky guess, basically.
It's much more than a lucky guess. But yeah, in a sense, it's a lucky guess.
So, and then you're fixing it with the classical limit because you want the Newtonian.
I'm fixing it with the non-relativistic limit because
okay.
I wanted to reproduce Newtonian gravity. So yeah, in a sense, it's a lucky guess. So Richard Feynman wrote this book on gravitation, which is quite interesting because he looks at it from particle physics point of view. The graviton is a particle which interacts and so on. And the way he describes it is that there is no way any particle physicist would have guessed that equation. Okay. What Einstein did, you see, instead of working up really, he had this. See, particle physicists had no idea that the graviton would be curvature of spacetime. They didn't have this idea of a manifold that's curved, which characterized by a Riemann curvature. This was the amazing thing, that somehow using that intuition that spacetime is a curved space with a Riemann tensor, and the fact that the Riemann tensor is a unique description involving two derivatives of the curvature, allowed Einstein to say, what else can it be? The equations are second derivative, involve only two derivatives on the matter and the gravity side. The only natural quantities characterizing the matter energy is the stress energy tensor. It must be this equation. Yeah.
Is G the only combination we can get?
Yes.
Not the cosmological constants.
Yeah. That's a very good point. In fact, I should have said that. There's an extra arbitrary thing you could add in this equation. When I said Einstein tensor, it's not quite unique. You see, so what you can do here is put lambda g alpha beta, where lambda is a constant. Okay? And then the metric is also covariantly symmetric and covariantly constant. Now, what I always do is I just imagine that's part of T. Okay. So, my way of thinking about it is that the cosmological constant, that is the modern way of thinking about it, the cosmological constant is just part of the energy density. Okay. So, but in Einstein's time, this was viewed as a free parameter. And you could add it to this equation. Doesn't really make any difference to any of these calculations, providing it's small.
Mm-hmm. Why couldn't kappa be some sort of Lorentz covariant scalar function? Like, why does that have to be a?
It can be. It absolutely can be. So There's nothing at all wrong with making this a function of some scalar field. And in fact, the stuff which I've mentioned to you vaguely involving conformal symmetry, that turns out to be a function of the Higgs field. Higgs field in particle physics exists. There's no reason why it doesn't contribute in this equation. And you can describe that by saying that maybe the Higgs field plays a role in determining Newton's constant. There's no reason why not. Absolutely consistent with the thing you have to be careful, you see, you're almost right, but the thing you have to be careful about is if I take covariant derivative of this guy, this is zero identically. If I put a function here, right, if this phi is not a constant, it's going to have a covariant derivative, and that will mess up this equation being correct. Okay, so it's a little bit more subtle than that. But essentially, when phi is if phi is a scalar field, if it's a constant, it doesn't alter that equation. Okay, so I think there's this announcement which you've heard about, which is very exciting. And so Monday is going to be a very, very fun day.